Hi, I'm Connor Cyrus, one of the hosts for Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy. We'll now turn our attention to the issue of adults who have aged out of the foster care system and the challenges they face in accessing their records from childhood. Our colleague Howard Weiss-Tisman covered this issue yesterday. You can hear his story and see photos from the Vermont State Archives at vermontpublic.org. Our first guest is Morrisville resident Nate Farnham. Nate is now a youth advocate and a former foster care kid. Nate, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Connor. I appreciate it.
Now, Nate, I'm wondering if you would just start by telling us how you ended up in foster care and a little bit about your story.
Yeah, absolutely. So I came into DCF custody on May 26th of 2006. Prior to that, there had been various home visits and, you know, other stuff via DCF social workers through a report that a neighbor had unfortunately made against my mother after her own kids had gotten taken into custody, unfortunately, due to her having a, you know, a substance abuse issue. And she was in the mindset of, well, you know, my mom was just as bad as her. Why are her kids getting taken and my mom still had me? So, you know, false allegations, you know, had been made. And that kind of resulted in me getting taken into custody. And unfortunately, my mom suffered from a broken back due to a truck driving accident. She was a truck driver, driving dump truck and stuff like that, got into a really bad accident and broke her back and was on permanent, you know, is on permanent disability because of it. Had rods and screws and stuff in her back. So Social Security, you know, disability was her monthly income, you know, $750. This was 2006. So it was a decent amount, but of course, it's hard to live off even that. So, you know, the apartment wasn't necessarily the greatest. You know, I always had food. You know, my life was good. I had pretty much everything I had ever wanted as a kid. I had pretty much all the old school, you know, video game consoles, Dreamcast, Genesis, you know, all the ones that we all reminisce about today. And I had food, you know, I had clothing by the bulk load of it.
So how old were you when you ended up in foster care?
So 2006, I was just shy, I believe, of my seventh birthday, if I do my math correctly, when I came into custody.
And what was that experience like for you?
It was extremely traumatizing, because instead of kind of just easing into it and basically, you know, kind of over time just saying, hey, unfortunately, you know, you're not going to be able to live with your mom anymore, it was Saturday morning, you know, normal Saturday morning, kind of wake up, go make myself, you know, a bowl of cereal with some toast, you know, get ready to watch the SpongeBob marathon on Nickelodeon in the morning. You know, mom's getting
ready. As we did.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the normal childhood stuff of our time. Your mom has to go to the bathroom. You know, she's going to get ready to watch it with me because that was our favorite show. We watched it together. You know, all of a sudden there's a knock on the door. So I go to answer the door, you know, and this 7-year-old kid, I figured, oh, maybe it was one of my friends or maybe one of mom's friends coming over. And all of a sudden I see, you know, a woman in a, you know, purple dress jacket, kind of blouse, you know, dressed up setting with a state trooper standing on each side of her. And basically right then and there, they're like, yeah, we're taking you into DCF custody. Like you're not living with your mom anymore. So that was pretty traumatic. Sat there and bawled my eyes out. I unfortunately actually assaulted the police officer because I'm like, you're not taking me from my mom. That's just not happening. So, I mean, it was, you know, of course at the time trauma just, you know, fight, flight or freeze. So, you know, my choice was fight. And that was obviously, you know, at the time the right decision in my mind. But now that I look back on it, I'm like, yeah, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have assaulted a cop.
But I mean, so you're 7 years old and you are now being taken away from your mom on a day that you thought was just going to be a regular day to watch
cartoons. Saturday.
What were the conversations I guess, after you were taken from your mom, what were those like, and how did you try to make sense of that?
So it was very hard for me. So I got placed into an emergency home that night, kind of just for the weekend, because there was obviously it was a Saturday, so there wasn't any judges that were going to be in a courthouse to, you know, kind of figure out a permanent placement thing. So I got sent to an emergency home for the weekend, and then that following Monday was when I kind of got brought into the DCF office and then brought to the courthouse, kind of went over every single thing. I got appointed my guardian ad litem. I got appointed my public defender lawyer, kind of got started getting my team appointed to me. Unfortunately, the first 2 years were extremely difficult. My mom, even though the allegations at the time were false, my mom had an alcohol and a substance abuse issue from being prescribed opiates for her back. When she broke her back, it was Oxycontin, oxycodone, and Percocets were the main things she got prescribed for pain tolerance, you know, to be able to, you know, kind of help dull the pain. But unfortunately, you know, that only works for so long before the dose gets maxed, and then even the max dose doesn't work. So then, of course, substance abuse takes over. You do more to dull the pain. And my mom had been taken into custody when she was a kid. So kind of that re-traumatized her, and for the first like 2 years, she was barely around for any meetings or anything like that. She just kind of went on a stupor of alcohol and substance abuse problems to try to cope with the fact that she had just lost her son to the state. So unfortunately, this 7-year-old kid had to very quickly turn into, you know, like a 24-year-old like I am now, to really kind of understand and learn the system and fight for myself, because my mom clearly wasn't there to do it.
Was foster care something that was that an easier life for you, or was that more difficult than living with your mom?
It was extremely more difficult. I mean, as time went on and as I grew older, of course, it started to become easier. But at least for the first 4 or 5 years, it was extremely difficult. Even throughout most of my time, the longest foster home I was ever in was my last 3 to 3.5 years in DCF. That was the longest time I'd ever spent in a home.
How many were you in?
Altogether, 35.
Oh, wow.
And then I went through 8 to 10 residential treatment facilities. And then I did 3 stays at the Brattleboro Retreat, Tyler Unit Psych Ward for medication stabilization. And that was actually my first year and a half within DCF. I went to that foster home for the weekend, and then they sent me there and started making me a walking pill factory, essentially, which was not fun.
So I want to talk about, so today's show is about, you know, accessing, you know, records from your childhood and stuff. But you seem to have a decent memory of what happened. Do you think you remember all of it?
I pretty much remember all of it. There are some things that were extremely traumatizing that occurred to me that I tried to remember but can't. And I think that's my brain locking those super traumatic events into a vault for me not to be able to gain access to. But 99% of my time, I remember. But as far as records go, like, I wanted access to my records when I first got out. I wanted to be able to have my documents, because that also had, you know, all of my medical history, you know, all of my social security information, you know, pretty much everything I would need in my adult life. And unfortunately, my mom had most of my medical records and everything else with a friend at their house, and in my baby chest with all my kid stuff in it, which also had all my medical records and everything else in it. That unfortunately got destroyed in a house fire years ago. So there went even the only copies I had other than my DCF records. So I really wanted to gain access to my records so I could have my medical history, my social security information, you know, all the information that I needed to get through life. And at first I was told, yep, just, you know, put something in writing and we'll send it up the channels. I checked in every, you know, on the day I put it in, every week for a month and never heard anything. And then not too long ago, when I started my legislative advocacy work, I was talking to one of the people within DCF on the higher up of the spectrum, either the commissioner or the deputy commissioner, one of the two, and was basically told I could get my records, but they'd be extremely heavily redacted. And I kind of sat there and pondered the question and did the German Shepherd sideways head cock and scratched my forehead and was like, why are my records of my time in my life going to be redacted? And they would sit there and say, well, it's, you know, for the serious incident reports and for the staff members that were involved or the foster parents that were involved. I was like, yeah, but I was there.
Yeah.
I lived every moment of that. I was there for that. I caused the physical, you know, damage to people and property that resulted in those SIR reports. I did every, you know, I was talking to the parents when this occurred. I was talking with the staff when this occurred. Like, I was there.
Does it feel like a violation to you to be able to have law enforcement, parents, attorneys, state officials have access to those records of your life and you don't have it?
Absolutely, it does. It totally feels like no more than, you know, me trying to say, well, I want all the records of your life, you know, and obviously being told no. But I feel like I'm the outsider to my own life. I feel like, you know, I'm that ghost that's sitting behind the physical me, and I can't get what I need. I can't get what I would like to be able to have that's of my life. Like, I understand confidentiality, HIPAA, all this other stuff, but I lived it. It's mine. Like, I was there for it all. So why am I being told no? You know, and I went through every channel that I possibly could, albeit going through the legal system, you know, via, you know, a lawsuit or a subpoena or, you know, whatever, or talking directly to the governor's staff and trying to get the governor to try to do something about it. So albeit those two options, I've done everything that I can. So I've basically kind of just let it go for now. I've also been busy with my other current youth advocacy work that I'm doing in the state house. So I kind of haven't had a chance to really turn my focus to that. But it was definitely, I had just talked to the representative I work with not too long ago to be able to kind of say, hey, once we get done what we're doing, I'd like to try to figure something out with this. So that's kind of my next step, is to start working on something.
What do you hear from other former or current foster care kids who are worried about accessing their records and not being able to see them when they become of age?
So right now, I actually unfortunately don't have a lot of connection with either, you know, youth in care or youth that are out of care. When I was with my youth advocacy group that I first kind of quote unquote cut my teeth into this work with, a lot of us felt the same way. You know, a lot of us, the four other people that I was kind of at the top, you know, leadership of the group with, the kind of four, five youth leaders that they kind of appointed, all of us were the same way. We were all about the same age, 17, 18, you know, 16. We wanted to be able to gain our records once we got out. So we kind of all had that same passion. And we were all ready to kind of do something about it. But unfortunately, the group that we were in wanted to strictly stay with policy change and not so much legislative work, which is why I left that group and kind of stepped into my own realm and cut my teeth a little bit harder on something new and a solo act. But I mean, I wouldn't have, you know, a hard time reaching out to him. I know that, you know, I'm friends with one of them on Facebook. So, but he's kind of completely stepped out of this line of work completely. I mean, he's got one or two kids now. So
I mean, it also can't be easy. And I also just want to take a second to thank you for being so open and honest about your childhood, because this is real pain.
It is.
And this is real life.
Extremely real. But If you can't talk about it, then you can't do my line of work. And I'm passionate about my line of work. I want to make sure that, you know, kids that, you know, have to unfortunately go through this same predicament that I went through don't have to go through the same trauma and, you know, abuse, whether it be psychological, emotional, or physical, that I unfortunately endured in my 13 years. That's kind of that. Like, I have to, you know, it happened. There's nothing I can do to change it, accept it, talk about it.
There's some ownership, too, that you want of your life when it comes to these records.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, they're mine. Why can't I have them? I understand HIPAA and confidentiality, but you don't need to redact my life from me.
I want to bring somebody else into the conversation. I want to bring Tanya Marshall. She is the state's archivist and chief records keeper. Tanya, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Connor. I appreciate being here today.
Now, Tanya, when it comes to the records of adults who've aged out of the foster care system, there are very specific restrictions. As of 2023, who can legally access these?
Well, I mean, there's different sets of records. So just to back up a little bit, one of the things that we were asked to do for the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration was to do a summary of the different laws related to placement, and that includes, it can be child placing agencies, so those would be nonprofit organizations, so those would be records that are not part of the government records, so to speak. There's also Department for Children and Families records, and then there's Judiciary records as well. And so to answer that question, it may be that be a little more specific of what set of records you might be asking to have access to and what the current law says.
I mean, if we did childhood records, is that too broad?
It just depends. For if we're talking about Department for Children and Families, for example, the law is pretty silent related to specifically on foster care records, but they do have, you know, a specific statute that gets into you know, what could be the department's own record keeping. And it's very explicit and it's very specific in terms of the department saying that they can only provide access if authorized by law. And then it itemizes a pretty long list of records that are accessible that are department records. But for former
foster care kids who weren't adopted, that creates a whole other set of challenges.
It creates a whole other set of challenges because for the department itself, the way the statute is written, it just says that they can't provide disclosure or they can't disclose the information unless it's authorized by law. And then in the actual statute, those who it's required to disclose to do not include individuals who have been, you know, placed as children. So it's the one group that is actually missing from that long list of individuals.
Now, a recent report from the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration was written in consultation with the Department of Children and Families and other parties. It included recommended changes to the law. What are some of those recommended changes?
Sure. So the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration is part of the Secretary of State's office. I'm the director of that administration in addition to State Archivist and Chief Records Officer. We did two recommendations. The first is more of a minor amendment to the existing statutes to explicitly include individuals who were placed as children. There's two areas of statutes. One's related to juvenile proceedings. One is related to department records. They do outline, you know, individuals who can receive access, but it's not explicit on individuals who are placed. So we added two what would be minor amendments. There's core differences on how that recommendation would play out. But we feel that those two areas, there already are individuals who are supporting the child and who are currently in care, who have access. So it seems to be the one, you know, those individuals who are actually placed are the ones that are missing from that law. And we did a second recommendation that was looking for really clear and concise legislation that encompasses the past as well as the present. A lot of our laws are based on children who are currently, you know, in foster care or in a residential child center.
Now, we know that each individual circumstance is very different and dictated by the law, which has changed several times, as you just said. In what ways are the laws written to reflect the contemporary landscape?
I think majority of the laws, and that's just standard, not just for this particular situation, but they are often written with the contemporary individuals, especially in the human services area. And part of our role as the Vermont State Archives and Records Administration is to bring some visibility to, you know, older records or records of the past and ensuring that the access is really understood, and also a way to remove exemptions over time. And so this is one area where, in terms of juvenile proceedings, in terms of Department for Children and Families records, it's very much written for the contemporary.
And before I let you go, I'm just curious, how can people that are listening that are frustrated by the current law, like Nate, who's right in front of me, how can they go about changing this or, you know, continue advocacy for changes in the way the state processes this stuff?
Well, I think the interesting part is the General Assembly asked for the report last year. So the report was part of Act 100 of 2022, which was an act related to access to adoption records. The legislators and lawmakers recognized that there was a gap as part of that. So the amendment that was added to the bill, which became the report, is asking. So we know that there's already legislative you know, interest and action desired as part of that. And our hope is that the report, which we did in consultation with Department for Children and Families and also interested parties that came forward, that it had the historical overview that the legislators really needed to see to understand, you know, that past and present. It included a summary of the existing types of records, because obviously we're talking about many different generations, and it had those two recommendations that that's, you know, minor amendments that will make significant changes of access for individuals, and then that broader, more concise past and present revision to the statutes in many different areas.
That's Tanya Marshall, the state's archivist and records keeper. You can hear more from Tanya and more detail about the state's archives from my colleague Howard Weiss-Tisman in a recent story on this very topic. You can find that story on our website, vermontpublic.org. Tanya, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So, Nate, as you hear that, does that all make sense to you? How complicated was it for you to navigate that system?
I understand every bit of that. Unfortunately, being, you know, the youth that had to grow up and become an adult extremely fast, kind of learned how to understand bureaucratic jargon is what we'll refer to it as. I understood everything that she just laid out. Unfortunately, I just kind of sit. I was sitting here like trying to maybe punch myself into the conversation to kind of speak my mind.
But what do you have to say?
And ask her a couple of questions. But I really fought myself on that, because I'm like, this is just going to dig us in a rabbit hole that we're not going to be able to get out of. I was mainly trying to maybe, you know, ask her in regards to what we had discussed prior to her coming on, which was, you know, like the I could get my records, but they'd be extremely redacted. You know, to me, that sounds like they had almost completely filled it, you know, filled me with BS, so to speak, because from what she was saying, I'm completely excluded in the statute for DCF records. You know, the other records I could get, but I'm not involved in those. Yeah. I'm strictly looking at like my DCF and judiciary records, which my judiciary records, from what she was saying, I could gain access to, but my DCF records are still, I'm not in that statute, which is mind-boggling, to say the least. I understand where they're coming from, but at the same time, when they made that statute, why wouldn't they include the youth?
Yeah,
They want the youth to just? Do they think the youth's just going to want to forget about it? I understand that. Mm-hmm. For the longest time, when I said, you know, when I was growing up, especially, you know, until I started getting into youth advocacy work, I was like, you know, as soon as I'm done with the system, I'm done. Like, I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want to remember it, any of that. And then I, of course, cut my teeth in youth advocacy, and that all changed. But I understand that, you know, there are youth that I don't even talk to anymore, because I'm part of the system as well. When they got out, they wanted nothing to do with the system. So any friends they made in the system, they cut.
Yeah.
I get that. But those of us that want our records should be able to gain access to our records.
Yeah. I'd like to welcome to the show Mike, who spent time in the Vermont foster care system. Mike, welcome.
Hello. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, Mike, we don't have a lot of time, but I want to get an understanding for your story. So will you give us an overview of your time in the foster care system?
Yeah. So back in 2011, I was put in foster care and stayed there until I turned 18. I moved around through a lot of foster homes in the state of Vermont and elsewhere. I have been in some great foster homes and some absolutely terrible ones. And then when I turned 18, I wanted to access my records for military purposes, and I had a really hard time. So when I got told that I could talk about my story on the radio, I was more than happy to accept, because I know that there's many other people just like myself who would very much like to have access to their records.
Now, it's interesting that you did not being able to access your records stop you from going into the military?
No. So thankfully, I was able to get in, but due to medical reasons, I was discharged. So when I left, I've been in the process of retrying to get my records to help assist me to get back in the military. And it's been proving just as difficult as it was before, meaning I haven't been able to access my records.
And why is it so important for you now? I mean, is it just the military, or like, do you feel some type of violation that you don't have access to your life?
Sure. So I would definitely concur that it's more than just me trying to get back in the military, right? It's the fact that DCF and local state governments need to have accountability, right? In my experience, what I experienced is very negative. So I would say that it's a way for me to see that everything was done by the book and that there was nothing that was done off the book, and really just hold the government accountable for what they did with my life. I don't agree with some of the placements they sent me to, and so as a direct result of that, I want to see what their reasoning was behind it. I want to see why, right? And as Nate here on the show has already mentioned, it's really, really difficult to get access to these records, so... Yeah,
Nate's over here shaking his head in agreement with you about that some of the systems or some of the places you were placed were great and others weren't. When it comes to, do you feel like DCF is hiding something from you by not being able to see your records? Is that what I'm understanding? I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I just want to try to get a better understanding.
Sure. Yeah, so I mean, it's possible that there's some stuff that they perhaps don't want me to see, but I would say that at the end of the day, DCF workers, when they choose on a placement for an individual, they aren't very good at vetting the places that they send these foster children to, including myself. And so I suppose this could potentially be a way to avoid possible lawsuits against DCF and kind of act as a legal protection by not allowing anybody who might be interested in potentially pursuing some sort of legal action with the Department of Children and Families from actually obtaining any records to see if there was any missteps taken or if there was a step taken that was really shouldn't have been taken in the first place.
Mike, thank you so much for joining the show and sharing your experiences with us. And good luck at getting your records.
Well, thank you, sir. I hope to, in September, I'll be accepting a contract for ROTC. So I'm pretty, really looking forward to being able to serve my country again.
Best of luck to you. Thank you so much.
You take care.
Nate, as you hear that, you're shaking your head. If you can, just respond to that in about 30 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel for him. And, you know, he seems like he knows what he's talking about and he's had some experiences. I might actually try to see if I can reach out to him, see if there's maybe something I can do in my advocacy work in the State House to kind of help figure some of this stuff out with him. As I feel based off what he said, we had a pretty similar experience. So I feel for him. I hope everything works out with him. It's great that he's, you know, was in the Army and is trying to get back into the Army. You know, that's dedication. I understand that from a firefighter EMT perspective. Yeah. And hoping to get in touch with him and figure that out with him.
Now we have one more guest, and our next guest is Gilly Hopkins, Permanency Planning Manager for the Department of Children and Families. Gilly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm sorry that we don't have a lot of time with you, but I'm wondering if we can just get you to respond to maybe some of the concerns that we've heard in today's show that pertaining to some adults not being able to access their childhood records and feeling that it's to cover up some stuff that DCF might have done in terms of missteps.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel confident saying that it has not been an intentional omission. The department is aware that there has been this omission in the law, and we have no legal authority to disclose these records. We are very excited that the legislature is likely to take this issue up, and we fully support the recommendations that Tanya made in the report that she recently submitted. Legislative change takes time and collaboration, and we work on a lot of different issues and balancing priorities. So we're so glad that this issue is coming forward now, and look forward to finding that common common ground and address the needs of youth and families that we serve.
Now, Gilly, when it comes to the laws around record privacy, adoption, foster records, it has evolved a great deal over the decades, but still could be improved upon. What would it take for these laws to become more cohesive?
Well, I think one of the challenges is that we do have a number of laws. So, you know, as Tanya has recommended in her report, I think it's going to take a comprehensive review of all of the interacting laws to get them to sync up. We will have, I think, continual challenges with the federal laws that are unlikely to change. There are parts of a DCF record, as you sort of conceptualize what's in that record, which is confidential information protected by federal law regarding people other than the child who is the subject of the record. So by that, I mean there is very often information that's protected by HIPAA or FERPA or other federal confidentiality laws regarding parents and other family members. So if a family member is struggling with a substance use disorder or a mental health struggle or even a health impairment that is a part of the reason for DCF's involvement, it's very challenging for us to disclose information regarding that protected condition of a health member, even though that is documented in the record of the young person who is the subject of the record.
That's Gilly Hopkins, Permanency Planning Manager for the Department of Children and Families. Gilly, thanks so much for joining us, and I'm sorry that your time was cut short.
That's quite all right. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. So, Nate, as you're hearing that, I want to give you the final word. We have about a minute left on the show. How do you respond, and what are your final thoughts?
I guess I understand where she's coming from in the aspect of, you know, FERPA, HIPAA, you know, confidentiality laws and everything like that. But I still stand by my merit and narrative of – I understand the family members, you know, everything she listed off, I understand that, but it was the life of the youth that lived in the DCF system. Not all kids are blind to everything around them, you know. As I stated, my mom has substance abuse issues and alcohol issues. I knew that. Doesn't mean I can't get my records from my next of kin when I know what problems they have. So I understand it, but at the same time, it's still irritates me in certain aspects.
It's definitely tough. And I just want to once again say thank you so much for joining us. I really respect and appreciate your honesty and vulnerability with us. That's Nate Farnham, a Morrisville resident and a youth advocate. Nate, thank you so much.
Connor, I appreciate the opportunity.